One of the things I did every time I was canvassing is I would bring my beagle, because I figured, well, people won't expect you to take your dog for a walk unless it's your own neighborhood. Like, who takes their dog in the car for 3 hours to go canvassing? So I did get a lot of people answering the door for me, and I like to think that the dog helped.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Melissa Michelson is a political scientist and the Dean of Social Sciences at Menlo College. She's currently chair of the Student Vote Research Network and an expert in Latinx voter mobilization and LGBTQ politics. She's another professor who comes out of the Yale Political Science doctoral program, who works with experiments to determine the efficacy of different political campaign actions. As head of Team Michelson, she engages in national research projects that double as mentoring efforts for younger scholars. If you are interested in the use of evidence in politics, you should definitely listen to my very engaging guest today, Melissa Michelson. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Melissa Michelson of Menlo College.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Melissa, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
I'm a political scientist. I've been a political scientist for about 3 decades. But before that, I was from Alameda, California. So I'm a California girl. And I'm also the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Menlo College. And I've been doing that for about 4 years. And I'm the chair of something called the Student Vote Research Network. And I also have a little group of women that I work with called Team Michelson. Team Michelson, I have my own little team.
Nice.
That brings me a lot of joy working with those folks. And so I do a lot of stuff both at Menlo College, obviously as the dean. I do stuff in the student voting space with the Student Vote Research Network. I do the research over here with Team Michelson. Yeah, I'm just doing lots of fun stuff all the time.
It seems like you are one of these prolific people that's always writing, administering in their case, administrating.
Yeah.
What does one do?
I'm doing a lot of stuff. I am really living a charmed life.
What was it like to grow up in Alameda? It seems like its own kind of world in a certain way when I visited it.
Yeah, well, you really can't even imagine, because when I was living there, it was also dominated by the Navy base. And so even though my family wasn't at that time part of the military, Alameda life was affected by there being this Navy base there, that we had color guards from the base at our graduations, that you'd end up having friends who lived on base. And so you'd end up going to base or going to that part of Alameda where there were the kinds of institutions that serviced the Navy community. And then it was also just a very safe place to grow up. So even though we were very close to some neighborhoods that maybe were more dangerous or more high crime, Alameda was just like this little island of domestic safety. So we grew up with that. And then there was the beach. And so probably growing up in Boulder, you probably played hooky once in a while to go play in the snow. Folks in Alameda, we'd play hooky and go to the beach and live our best life. And so it really was pretty freaking great growing up in Alameda.
There might be some parallel with growing up in Boulder, actually, because Boulder was its own kind of enclave, liberal enclave. We roamed the neighborhoods as kids without fear and biked around in circles and up and down in the foothills and didn't worry about the outside world too much, honestly.
I mean, we were an island. Nobody hung out in Alameda. They went to Berkeley and Oakland. And as a teenager, I went and hung out in Berkeley and Oakland. But as a kid, you're just living in this little island paradise. It was great.
I'm guessing you were a pretty good student there if you having tracked your path through life a little bit.
I feel like I have gotten to be a very good student. And I think when I was a kid, I did not push myself to my highest level. I had a lot of fun in high school.
One doesn't have to push themselves to the highest level at that level yet, right? And in fact, some of the kids that do maybe burn themselves out a bit.
Yeah, I definitely didn't burn myself out in high school. I was really enjoying my life. I was on the track team, and I remember the track coach was also the guidance counselor. And so I applied to colleges. I applied to 3 colleges in New York. I knew I really wanted to go to New York. Columbia ended up being one of them. I remember I got into Columbia and I mentioned it to my track coach at practice, and he said, "Oh, I didn't know you were that smart," which is really
it's a backwards way of determining someone's intelligence.
Well, it's a sign of how poor of a guidance counselor he was. But I think I didn't know what I was getting myself into. Honestly, I was just like, yeah, that's in New York City. Perfect. But yeah, it does turn out I'm pretty smart, I guess. That worked out, and I had great times at Columbia. So,
is it true that you carried that track team, that running habit, through into your life?
Yes. Yes, I am. I am still a runner. I have been a runner throughout. I was on something at Yale when I was in graduate school called the Yale Co-op running team, and also competed in triathlon in grad school. But yeah, since high school, I've been a competitive runner.
One of the great things about running is it seems open to anybody. It's so much more about effort than it is about almost anything else. You keep doing it, you get better at it to a degree.
To a degree. And I think part of the reason it appeals to me, well, there's a couple things about it that appeal to me. One of them is that the barriers to entry are very low. It's not like lacrosse or hockey where you're going to need a bunch of equipment. It's not a team sport, so you don't have to worry about scheduling it. You just need a pair of shoes, or you can run barefoot on the beach. You know, you can just go. And I think for me, it's just really nice to have that alone time. I am very busy. I have 4 boys. I have a lot of responsibilities. But when I go running, it's just me.
When you're running, do you find yourself thinking about your academic work, solving problems, or is it a time of not thinking? Yeah.
I used to. When I was in grad school, especially, I remember I would spend my running time thinking through problems and thinking about what's wrong with my code? Why isn't it working? How am I going to answer this question? These days, I'm mostly just listening to music or podcasts and trying not to think about work.
Yeah. Reasonable. Tell me about Columbia. How was that for you?
So Columbia was amazing. I got to go to New York, and so I was super excited that that worked out. I did have a bit of a imposter syndrome moment because, you know, I came from Alameda High School and I was not the most diligent student. And I got thrown into this mix of students who had gone to prep schools and had read all these books and were just like super smart. And I was just like, oh, maybe there's been a mistake. Maybe I wasn't supposed to get into the school. Like, I remember going to class and the professor is assigning the Odyssey or some other piece of great work. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, we read this in high school. I was like, in AP English, we read Clan of the Cave Bear. And so I just was cramming a lot. So I remember being really stressed out about that. On the other hand, Columbia was amazing. I joined the Columbia Daily Spectator right away. I found running friends right away. I took great advantage of New York City. I was going downtown, going down to Greenwich Village quite a lot, going to Central Park to go running and to go ice skating. And New York was great. Columbia was great. So I had a fantastic time, made great friends, figured out that I wanted to be a political scientist, which we can talk more about if you want, and not a journalist. It was a great 4 years.
My observation is it's only very intelligent people who are afflicted with imposter syndrome. People who don't understand things, who don't have enough perspective, just think they're fine. I don't know if that's true. That's not a...
I want to believe it. That's a very compelling twist on it. Like, if you're not feeling imposter syndrome, you don't even know what you don't know.
I think the smart people I know the extent of their knowledge and can recognize when someone else is ahead of them, whereas other people, maybe the former president of the United States, one back, would have no idea that someone else knew more than he does.
Well, let's not talk about him.
Okay.
But yes, I like that.
You told me that you figured out that you want to be a political scientist there. Did you have a particular mentor?
Yes. Okay. This is a really good story. I love telling the story. So when I was at Columbia, I signed up for a class called Race and Class, and it was taught by Professor Charles Hamilton. And as a kid from Alameda who didn't pay a ton of attention in school, I had no idea what I was signing up for. But of course, Charles Hamilton is the co-author of Black Power, and he's quite a well-known figure in the civil rights movement. And so I took this class with him, and I can't remember what the paper was about, but I wrote a paper for him, and on it he wrote, "Come see me." Right, which struck terror into my heart. So I went to see him, and keep in mind at the time that I'm working for the school paper. I think at that time I was an editor at the school paper. And he says, "Listen, Melissa, I know that you think you want to be a journalist. But let me tell you, when I come home at night, my wife gives me a glass of wine, my slippers, and the newspaper, and I drink my wine and I read the paper. And when I'm done with the newspaper, I throw it into the fire. I don't think you want to write things that are discarded like this, right? I think you want to change the world. And to do that, you need to write books and you need to become a political science professor." And I was like, "No, you don't know me. You nuh-uh." And he's like, "Okay." And he gave me this book to read called Impact. And he said, "Go read this and come back." And so we ended up having a series of conversations. And eventually I was like, "Well, shit, I do want to be a political science professor. And I do want to write books and try to change the world." And my favorite, part of my favorite, this is so eloquent. Part of the reason this is my favorite story is because of the ending, because they had a celebration at Columbia for the 50th anniversary of Black Power. And I happened to know that they were doing this, and I got in touch with Fred, who was the organizer, who I knew from political science, and said, "You have to let me come because I have to come and tell this story about how Dr. Hamilton changed my life." And Fred was like, "Yes, you absolutely must come tell this story." And so I got to stand up during the celebration and tell the story and tell Dr. Hamilton that he was right and that I had written a bunch of books and that I thought maybe I was helping change the world, and to thank him for helping me make that happen. And it was just like, oh my gosh, like I'm getting emotional about it right now. It was so great.
Do you think he did that for a lot of students, or do you think?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he did. And so I shouldn't feel like I'm so special, but I was certainly the only one at that dinner who said it.
Yeah. You said you don't remember what the paper was about that he seized on originally. Do you have any sense of what you brought to that paper? Was there something in your bones that did want to change the world that
yes,
you think came out in that paper?
I think that's what it was, what I got from him, or at least what I'm thinking it was now, you know, 30 odd years later, is that he saw I wasn't somebody satisfied to just say, "Here's what all the things we read say. Here I have repackaged it for your consumption." It was me engaging and pushing back and saying, "But really? But what about this?" And in a way, kind of asking too many questions and saying, but that can't be right. You know, I'm not satisfied. So I wasn't just regurgitating the class material, and I wasn't even just regurgitating his lectures, that I was saying, like, I have my own thoughts. So
I think there's a certain type of person that has a probably innate sense of justice that directs them through life. Do you think you're that sort of person?
I like to think I am. I like to think that's what my parents gave me.
You think your parents were that way?
Absolutely. I think at certain points in my parents' lives, they were activists in the movements of the 1960s. My dad tells me stories about being in Georgia during the 1960s. So I know that he was one of those Jewish allies who went down there and tried to help. And there has always been the sense that I got from my family that you should be helping. My mom now in her 70s, in her retirement, is still volunteering and going and cooking for people who are unhoused and giving back and trying to make a difference. So I think I really did get it from them.
What is that book, Impact? I don't recognize that. I feel like I should.
Well, keep in mind, this is like the early 1980s. So
I was quite around at that point.
So you were around. If I were to go and look at my bookshelf, I'd probably be able to find it.
Did he write it?
Or who? No, wrote it? He didn't write it. He was just recommending it to me as if to say, like, you want to make an impact. Here's a book about how to make an impact. I honestly don't remember the book at all. I've kept it for sentimental reasons, but I haven't read it for decades.
It looks to me from your various biographies I've found that you went straight to grad school. Is that right?
That's true. Once Dr. Hamilton had talked me into it, I thought, okay, better go to grad school then because I'm going to need a PhD. So yeah, I went straight through.
And you managed to pick Yale, which is a...
Well, I would say Yale picked me.
Yeah.
So I was not the only one applying to graduate school. My friends were applying to graduate school as well. And so I applied to a whole bunch of graduate schools, Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, Yale, and then a couple of safeties. And as my friends were getting their acceptance letters from Princeton and Harvard, I was getting rejection letter after rejection letter. And while I had not yet heard from Yale, I ended up saying yes to one of the safeties because I was like, well, if Stanford and Princeton and Harvard and Cornell, all these schools don't want me, I see what's happening here. So I guess I'll go to this school over here. And then I finally got the letter from Yale. And had to call the school that I had previously said yes to and said, like, I know I said I was coming, but I'm not. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I got into Yale. And they're like, yeah, but our program, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm sorry, did you not hear what I just said? I got into Yale, going to Yale. It was a pretty horrible thing for me to say at the time. But I was just so relieved, like, I'm not going to be the only one of my friends who didn't get into a prestigious graduate school.
Looks like you were there in 1990 to 1994. I had graduated from that school as an undergrad in 1988. So we're not that far apart. And I took a couple classes there in political science. I was a computer science major. David Mayhew, Edward Tufte, and a few people like that I remember from the department.
Yeah, and Mayhew was on my dissertation committee. I TA'd for Tufte multiple times. I love those guys.
Yeah. And I have also interviewed recently, as you know, Don Green and David Nickerson, one who was a grad student of Don Green's and now teaches himself. And so I have this weird view of what Yale graduate political science was from a couple different angles. But tell me your angle.
I think mine was probably really different from David's.
Because David was right there at the beginning of the Green and Gerber experiment stuff.
Right. And I was there way before, right? I am actually Don Green's first PhD student. So I figured out that I was going to go to Yale, and I went and told my undergraduate advisor, who was Bob Shapiro. And Bob said, oh, when you get to Yale, look up this guy, Don Green. They just hired him. I'll tell him, you know. And so when I got to Yale, I went to Don Green's office and said, hi, Bob sent me. And he said, great, do you want to be my research assistant? And at the time, he was studying like hate crimes in North Carolina, and he was doing some stuff with ballot initiatives in California. This was way before he started doing the Get Out the Vote experiments. So I worked with him, and that was super fun. And then the other thing about Yale that comes to mind is I realized that there was something called the University Senate, the Student Senate, and that the political science department at Yale didn't have a senator. And so I went to the faculty advisor, I can't remember who, and said, hey, can I be the senator? We should be represented. And they said, okay, great, you're the senator. And then a little while later, there started to be this huge student union movement at Yale, and all of the graduate students were organizing and pushing back to be recognized. And I had been working on some of the same issues that the union was concerned about within the student government as their senator. But instead of seeing the Senate as an ally and seeing us as all trying to get the same things accomplished, I became very unpopular with people going around talking about me, saying we should be forcing Melissa to give up her seat, with other students screaming at me in public that I should resign and that I was a tool of the administration. It was really very unpleasant.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was not feeling like I wanted to hang out at Yale a long time. I was like, well, this sucks. You people are mean. I don't like it here. I also found my imposter syndrome coming up again. So I'm going to take your interpretation of that. But I very much was like, I'm not sure I'm supposed to be here. That was probably reinforced by the fact that I hadn't gotten into any of the other prestigious graduate programs. So I just worked really, really hard to finish as quickly as possible. And one of my favorite stories about this is I had been working with Don, and he said, you know, if you work really hard, you could be done this year. And so I was like, oh, it's only my fourth year of graduate school. I was like, oh, okay. So I went to this session that Ian Shapiro, the chair, would hold every year for students about to go on the market. And I remember I was sitting there, and the whole time he's looking at me right in the eyes as he's saying things like, now you shouldn't go on the market unless you're really going to finish. You shouldn't go. And afterwards I was like, no, really, I'm almost done. Don says I'm almost done. He's like, oh, okay. I could tell he was like, what are you doing here? You're not possibly done.
Well, most people don't get out in 4 years unless they really kind of come in with a topic and are ahead of the game.
I treated grad school like a job. I went to the library every morning and I made sure I sat there for 6 hours looking through the government documents that were the basis of my dissertation. So I spent 6 hours a day in the government documents library, and that's how I finished so quickly.
It sounds like you must have, I don't know whether it was as an undergrad or here, worked on the statistical analytical side of things. Is that right?
Yes, very much. And I went on the market as a methodologist.
What attracted you to that? Or was it a tool that was necessary for the kind of things you wanted to do?
I really liked it. I've always been good at math. My dad, after he retired, became a math teacher. So I just was always brought up to think math is fun. You know, math is useful. Math is interesting. And my dad also was in the computers world. I'm just from my parents got this interest in math and statistics. My dad has a master's degree in biostatistics. So I just was drawn to it as something that, like, yeah, Michelsons are good at math. Michelsons are good at statistics. And it turned out that I was good at it. And then I got this reinforcement from Don. And of course, the idea that as a woman going on the market as a methodologist, I would be very marketable. And so even if my interests, you know, in terms of, you know, social justice work or other substantive areas of political science were important to me, I knew that being a methodologist was going to get me a great job and was a tool that was going to help me answer my research questions.
What was your dissertation?
It was about the effect of public approval on presidents' ability to get their priority legislation approved by Congress.
I'm going to guess it's helpful to have a higher approval rating.
On the margins, it is helpful.
Yeah. I mean, Mayhew has that interesting book about divided government and how, if I remember correctly, a similar amount of big legislation goes through in unified government as divided government. It's sort of analogous, public opinion being up or down. Like, there are lots of different factors that might influence whether something actually passes or not.
Yeah, of course. And one of the professors that I had at Columbia, what was his name? He was the national security advisor for Carter, and he wrote his book about presidential power.
Wait, is that Brzezinski?
Did also take a class with Brzezinski, but yeah. No. Oh, it was another guy.
Maybe, I don't know.
The point is, he also talked about like the effect of being a popular president. And there's all these different reasons why being popular might help you. The Congress might see it as a referendum on your proposals. Congress might want to try to tap into that popularity by doing the same things that a popular president is doing. There were all kinds of very compelling theoretical reasons as to why it would work. But what I was doing was doing like high end statistical testing of it. So we can all kind of say like, yes, of course, logically, more popular presidents will get more stuff done. And I was like, yeah, but I'm going to prove it with math. I often say that my work is about proving what we already know, but with math. You know, with numbers. So you might think that X works because logically it works and you've got a really strong theory, but hey, here's some hard evidence. Now we know it's true.
So you finished in the 4 years and went on the market?
I did. I did. And
that must have felt pretty good.
Felt really good. Felt really good to just say goodbye to all of the haters. And say goodbye to the poverty of being a grad student. And yeah, it was super exciting. And then I got to go to Chicago. My first job was at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, but that was just for a year. And then I went to Chicago and I just had a blast there as well. Kai, should not leave out Appleton, Wisconsin. That was an important year too, but.
Well, tell me about it. What was important about it?
So it was my first year teaching. As Tufte's grad assistant, as Don Green's research assistant, I really had done zero teaching, which as a dean now, I would never hire someone with zero teaching experience.
Well, Tufte liked to be the showman, right? He wanted to teach the classes, if I remember.
Yeah. And it just wasn't an opportunity that I had a chance to take to maybe teach my own class or run my own section because I finished so quickly. So I would never hire somebody like me, but these folks did. And so I get to Lawrence and I'm teaching my classes and I'm working so hard. I'm prepping every lecture for hours and hours. And I remember the chair came to see me. He's like, Melissa, I understand you're reading your lectures. I was like, is that wrong? He's like, yeah, you can't read your lectures. You have to stop that. So that year I really learned how to teach, which was super important. And, you know, got my footing in terms of like, this is how you can be a professor in a place that was nice and small, was very collaborative, right? Which was a change from Yale and is very different from the University of Illinois, Chicago. This nice little community I made great friends there and had a lot of fun in the snow.
You had a lot of people teaching you. Were some of them reading their lectures to you? What were you modeling that on?
At Columbia, many professors that I took read their lectures. Yeah, that was like the old school way of teaching and just seemed to me at the time to be a really organized way of making sure you were prepared, that you knew what you needed to say. And I think what I had lost sight of and what I realized more and more is I have this brain full of information and you don't have to give that all to the students in their first semester of political science. It's okay to just give them a little taste instead of making sure they have every single fact and every single nuance. That can wait till grad school, you know, that can wait for later. But I was trying to make sure I was so comprehensive. And I think I still had imposter syndrome. I looked very young. Oh, listen, I have several things to tell you about this first year. I went to the local high school for a blood drive and was asked for my hall pass. I went to the ID office at Lawrence to get my picture taken for my ID. And they said, oh, are you a new student? I said, no, I'm a new faculty member. And the woman reached across the counter and pinched my cheek and said, oh, but you look so young.
How tall were you?
I was and am 5'4".
Yeah.
And I am a small person. After that, I started dressing up in like the most stereotypical professor outfits you can imagine. I was wearing tweed jackets and long skirts and my hair in a bun. I was so determined that people would realize I was the grown-up and not an undergraduate student, right? This was an undergraduate college. There was no chance of me even being mistaken for a grad student. I was either an undergrad or a faculty member, and I was just traumatized.
That was your year in Lawrence.
Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And then I got to go to Chicago.
Well, were you during that year also working on your research? So you're a busy young woman at that stage.
I did not get anything published. And in fact, when I got to Chicago, Doris Graber was on the faculty there in the department, and she took me under her wing and she helped me get my first publication. I was like, okay, I get it now. So as much as, you know, Dawn and the other folks at Yale had really prepared me to do research, I really hadn't learned the game of how you take your research and get through the peer review process and get a publication. And Doris taught me how to do that. And then that started happening.
What was the area where you started to publish?
Well, at first I started to try to publish parts of my dissertation. And so my first publication, which is the only one that was a part of my dissertation, was about how public opinion was part of the battle over foreign policy things like the Panama Canal treaties during the Carter administration.
How long were you at Chicago and how did that go?
I was there for 4 years and it was great. I loved being in New York. I loved being in Chicago. Just was living the life of being a young single person in a big city and having all of the fun. But the other thing that happened at Chicago was that another one of my colleagues, her name is Amalia Payares, and this is 1994, and you might remember that there was a lot going on with Latino politics in the mid-1990s. And so she came to me and she said, I have this idea for a survey. You're a survey expert. Can you help me? And I said, well, I'll help you if we're co-authors. You know, I need publication. We were both new in the same year. And so I was like, well, let's do it together. And so we did. We did this great project where we did a survey of Latinos in Chicago. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I started doing more and more stuff in Latino politics. And then at the same time that I was doing that, I became involved with a man who happened to be at Stanford, which meant that it was going to be a problem if I was in Chicago and he was in California. And that worked out logically in my head of if I become an expert in Latino politics, I will be more likely to get a job in California because there's a lot going on with Latino politics in California, like Prop 187, which was in 1994. So why don't I give up this research I've been doing on presidential power and public opinion more generally? I'm going to pivot to Latino public opinion, and I'm going to go on the market and get a job in California.
Yeah, I wondered about that move to the Bay Area and what occasioned it. Now I understand a little bit. Who is this mystery person that you...
Well, keep in mind, right? My parents are in California. I grew up in Alameda. After I left, my parents moved to Palo Alto, and I was going home and visiting. And so on one of those visits, I met this guy. I don't really want to talk about him because he's the first husband and not the current husband.
Okay,
but
with me. But still.
But still, it was enough of a draw.
He made a geographic difference for you.
He did. I probably would have ended up staying in Chicago if I hadn't gotten married.
Yeah. Were you excited about being a professor in California?
I was. And the first job I got in California was in Fresno. And Fresno was very interesting at the time. There's a lot of fun stuff going on. And I loved my department. And I loved my students. And that's when, so in April of 2001, I went to the Midwest Political Science Conference in Chicago. And I was walking down the sidewalk and, you know, there's 5,000 political scientists in town. And I run into Don and he's like, hey, Alan and I just did this really cool get out the vote experiment in New Haven. You should do it with Latinos in California. And so I did because it was a great idea. And that was the first one that had been done on Latinos that was for a 2001 election in a little town near Fresno.
Boy, that particular work couldn't be more relevant today.
Right?
Right. What did you do? What did you learn?
Sure. So what I did is I hired 40 undergraduate students. And for two weekends, right before the election, we went to this city called Dos Palos. And we went door to door to try to contact our treatment group. So we just totally copied what Don had done. We did door to door canvassing, treatment and control groups. And we worked really, really hard. It was a small election. I think there were 1,700 people on the voter rolls. So we contacted 70% of the people on our treatment list. And then it worked. We were able to notably increase turnout among the Latinos that we contacted. And that was important because it said, well, this stuff that Don and Alan did with a general population, it also works for Latinos, which was an open question before we did it.
He had different forms of voter contact in his study. Did you try multiple different forms or was it all canvassing?
We only did canvassing, but we did copy his two script randomization of one of it being about civic duty and one of the scripts being about being a voice for your community. And we actually had a bit of a debate about it, which Ali Valenzuela and I think answered pretty well in a paper in 2016. So it took a while, but based on his initial experiments, he said, well, it doesn't look like what we say matters. It just matters that you go to someone's house. And I said, I don't think that can be right. It must matter what you say. And I think eventually we have figured out that it does matter what you say. And that thing that you need to say is different. And the key is to figure out, well, for this group of people, you need to say this, but for this other group of people, you need to say that. And that's why in those early efforts, it didn't look like there was a difference between civic duty and community voice. It started a fun conversation with Don about that.
Did you do other things that were in that vein subsequently in the sort of study of get out the vote and experimental design?
Hundreds of them. So one of the pieces of feedback I got about that first effort was, well, all of your canvassers were Latino, which is true because I was like, well, we're going to this small rural town in California. Everyone who works for me needs to be bilingual. And guess what? Everyone who fit the job requirement ended up being Latino because those were the people who spoke Spanish. So I thought, okay, well, I need to do an experiment reaching out to Latinos where I can vary the race of the canvasser. And so for the next election, I did that. And I hired white and Asian and Black and Latino students. And then we only targeted young Latinos to get out the vote, figuring young Latinos are going to tend to speak English, which was true. And then we were able to test what difference it made that the person coming to your door was your same race.
Did it make a difference?
It did, but not for the reason that we thought it did. It gave us a higher contact rate. So people were more willing to answer the door. And then if you control for contact rate, the effect was the same. So it mattered.
So someone's peeking out and saying...
No, absolutely. That's what they would do. They'd peek out between the blinds or like you'd hear some noise behind the keyhole and either they would answer the door or they wouldn't.
Was the opening of the door what you might guess that a Latino would open a door to another Latino more quickly than they would to a white or black person? Or how did that?
They were more likely to open the door.
Yeah.
They were just more likely to open the door. And I mean, it makes sense if you've got, you know, strange people in your neighborhood. They're clearly not from your neighborhood because they're not your race. We're talking about pretty segregated communities. Maybe they're holding a clipboard. They look official. Like, I don't know. I'm answering the door for these people. Like, I don't know what they want. It resonates, you know, and in some interactions that I had, like I remember I answered the door and a little kid yells back, "Hey, Ma, there's a lady with a clipboard at the door." So, you know, it.
Better than a lady with a gun.
Definitely better. Definitely better. But I think that's what people were saying is there's a stranger at the door with a clipboard.
Yeah.
Do I want to answer the door?
Yeah.
One of the things I did every time I was canvassing is I would bring my beagle because I figured, well, people won't expect you to take your dog for a walk unless it's your own neighborhood. Like, who takes their dog in the car for 3 hours to go canvassing? So I did get a lot of people answering the door for me. And I like to think that the dog helped.
Another strain of your work seems to be in the LGBTQ area. How did that become another subject for you?
I love telling you all these fun stories. Okay, so.
I love hearing all these fun stories.
So some years ago, I guess it was 2009 or 2008, Jamie Druckman invited me to a conference at Northwestern that he and Don and some other folks were organizing. They were putting together a handbook of experiments. And so Don sent one of his grad students to pick me up. And the young man who he assigned to pick me up is named Brian Harrison. And as you probably already know, Brian's the co-author of 3 books and many articles with me on this topic. And so what happened is once I was in his car, Brian had done his homework. And he said, "You've done all this stuff on getting out the vote in Latino communities and Black communities and Asian communities and youth. What about getting out the LGBT vote?" And I said, "Oh, sure, that'd be interesting. Let's try to do that." And so we stayed in touch, and it turned out we couldn't do that for an experiment because we couldn't get a good database of who was gay. But we did a fundraising experiment in partnership with One Iowa about raising money for marriage equality. That was a huge success. And Brian is really smart and really innovative and fun to work with. And so we just kept writing stuff together.
Do you find people assume that you're gay Latina?
Absolutely. They assume both of those things. And I try to, as soon as possible, say, "I am a proud ally. I am Jewish and I am married to a man. I am not a member of the LGBTQ community, but I am an ally. I am not Latina, but I am an ally." And I think as long as you're honest with people, they appreciate it. And it actually has given me some appreciation, probably not even close, right? For sure, not even close, but some appreciation for the coming out thing, the challenge of coming out, because I'm in so many rooms where it's assumed and I'm like, I need to say this. I need to tell them. How am I going to get this into the conversation? This is awkward. I'm feeling awkward. I need to tell them.
You have to come out.
I can't let things go too far.
It's the opposite kind of coming out in a funny
exactly,
way.
Exactly. It's the opposite. But I feel like that's actually really good for me to have that kind of empathy of, I have a secret.
Do you find some people ever less willing to listen to you because you're not of the communities that you're writing about?
Not to my face. I think I have a pretty strong level of credibility. My peers chose me multiple times to be the president of the Latino Caucus, the president of the LGBTQ Caucus, that I'm still involved in leadership in those arenas, given that for decades they have known.
You've earned your stripes.
That exactly. I feel like the recognition I've gotten in terms of being entrusted with those positions and the feedback I've gotten is that they appreciate me. But I think it's also probably true that some people are a little bit dismissive of my work because I'm not a member of the community.
There's definitely a community of activists, who do methodological things that are organized. Like there's the Analyst Institute, groups like that that study for the political progressive world, things like turnout, things like experiments, trying to understand what works and what doesn't work out there. To what degree are you integrated into that, those kind of networks?
Well, I'm a member of the Analyst Institute, but I think actually Team Michelson is a competitor.
Well, so tell me, what is Team Michelson? Because you mentioned it and I didn't know what it did.
Sure. So Team Michelson is, I have these, at this point, only women, although we did once let a man be a part of Team Michelson, so we're open to it. But it's assistant professors, graduate students who are interested in the kind of work I do and want to collaborate with me. And so I either get contracts from community organizations or I get grants from funders, and then we go out and we do research. And the reason is it exists is because I'm at Menlo College. I've been at Menlo College for about 14 years now. We are not only an undergraduate institution, but there's no political science major. It's a business school. And while we also offer arts and sciences, and I'm the proud dean of arts and sciences, and we have one major in psychology and two minors, there's not a pool of potential collaborators for me to work with. I was the only political scientist here when I was here, and I had no grad students. So I was like, okay, if I'm going to do collaborative research and if I'm going to mentor young people into what I do, I'm going to have to bring them in from other schools and make this kind of side gig. And so that's Team Michelson. It's these young people that I've met at conferences or through references that are interested in working with me, but aren't affiliated with Menlo College.
From doing all this work in this area, what do you think you know about the way people respond politically that maybe isn't known by campaign operatives and or do you know anything? Like, if you know what works in mobilizing a gay Latina or something, who should be reading what you wrote, or that is a practitioner in politics?
Yeah. Well, I actually think a lot of people that our practitioners do read my work. And I try very hard to make it accessible to practitioners and to talk to practitioners all the time. Folks who want to get out the vote in any community should be reading this work, because it's all about how you have to have trusted messengers, about how you have to understand what it is that the community is concerned about. Like, universal truths that if I say it to anybody, they're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Which I feel like just doubles down on my statement that what I do is prove things that folks thought they already know. I feel like people are starting to get to know these things, but maybe they don't always understand the degree to which it requires ongoing investment or, you know, repeated relationships, that you can't just, you know, put a billboard up in town and say, hey, don't forget to vote.
Do you get the question, I'm assuming you do, that about like what's going on broadly with the Latino vote in this country? Because it seems more contested of late than maybe it was. And progressive Democrats are worried. What do you think is going on right now? Can you speak to that kind of broadly?
Absolutely. Actually was just talking to my students about this and trying to help them put it into a historical perspective, because at least what I think is going on is we're just kind of going back to the way things were in the late 80s or even the early 2000s. I think people forget, you know, George W. Bush got 40% of the Latino vote in 2004. Ronald Reagan got 35% of the Latino vote. The Latino vote has always been split. There's always been a lot of Latinos who are buying into what Cristina Beltran calls multicultural whiteness. There have always been Latinos who are more interested in closing the door behind them, as David Gutierrez talks about in Walls and Mirrors, like maybe Latinos who are here will be treated better and discriminated against less if we build the wall and shut the border. There's always been splits like that in the Latino community. And so while there was a decrease in Latino support for the Republican candidate when Obama was on the ballot. I think what we're really seeing is just a return to normalcy, not a huge spike in Latino support for Republicans, but a return to previous levels of Latino support for Republicans that are evidence of these divides in the community.
The Republicans have chosen the transgender area to really fight the culture war in kind of a gruesome way. It's another thing that you've worked on and have written about. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing there?
Yeah. Again, this is like a history repeating kind of a thing, because this kind of demonization and fear-mongering about transgender people is very much what the Republican was doing when it comes to gay people in previous decades. And they can't really do that very effectively anymore, because most people are very comfortable with gay and lesbian people and no longer see them as scary deviants who are going to convert their children. And the Republican Party has basically just recycled all of those messages and now attached them to transgender people. And for now, it's been fairly effective, especially when they're talking about children and transgender children participating in sports, or somehow, you know, turning kids transgender or exploding the gender binary. But I actually think it's going to be short-lived in a similar way, because there's more and more visibility of transgender people. There's more and more young people who are aware that maybe gender isn't a firm binary and that they're comfortable with that. And I think eventually it will stop working as more and more people realize they already know and love a transgender person. Just like in the 90s, they started to realize, oh, I already know and love a gay person.
That's a kind of an optimistic view that warms my heart, but doesn't allay all my worry about what we have coming. Because depending on how things go, electorally and otherwise, there's really a potential to go way backwards, I think.
Absolutely. In the short term, this is working. This is absolutely. I think my optimism is more, you know, looking ahead. But in the short term, the Republicans have found that sweet spot of, here's the stuff we can say about transgender people that scares folks and makes them vote Republican instead of creating backlash. And they honed that, right? The bathroom bill stuff didn't work. The transgender people in the military stuff, that really didn't stick. But transgender kids in sports, that's hitting. They tested all the messages and they found the one that works. And right now it's working. But I also do think that history will repeat and eventually people be like, no, I'm not afraid of transgender people. I'm not worried about transgender kids in my school.
What is your work focused on currently?
So many things. So I'm doing some work in voter mobilization, trying to see if interventions in high school with seniors has an effect on people. I'm doing some work on what I call knowledge brokering with my team, which is about how when you reach out to college students, which is a lot of the work that folks in the student voting space are doing, when you talk to college students, to what effect are they then bringing that information home and then sharing with their families or their neighbors, hey, here's how you negotiate this process. And maybe that's more likely to happen in immigrant communities or in places where you're a first generation college student. So we're looking at that. Probably the most exciting thing I'm doing right now is I'm finishing up a book manuscript with a couple of Team Michelson members that is a collaboration with Black Girls Vote. And we did experiments in a number of cities in 2020, 2021, 2022. On how to get out the vote in Black communities with celebrations of community, with Black joy. And the book is all about how you can get low propensity Black voters to participate with these messages, with making it a party, with making it a celebration. Really excited about that book.
Do you know a group called All Americans Vote? Tamer Mokhtar runs it. He's close to Reid Hoffman, who has funded a bunch of stuff in the...
I recognize all those names.
He's funded a bunch of stuff in the community of celebration around voting. And that's
the
one of the things...
election festivals kind of stuff.
That's one of those things that they think Civic Nation, I think, is in there.
Yep. We are definitely building off of their work.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just talked to him the other day about what he's doing. And that's... he's focusing in rural North Carolina and in Milwaukee and places like that.
The swing states.
Yeah.
That's where the money is. And that's was part of the challenge of the book for sure, because when Black Girls Vote President Nike Robinson was fundraising for the project, people are like, well, can you go to Atlanta? You know, can you go to Georgia for the runoff Senate election, when it was all about that runoff election in 2021? Can you go to Detroit? And we're like, yeah, but could we have some money for some places where it's not a battleground state and all eyes of the nation are upon it? And this happens quite often where the money is trying to get you to go to these hot battleground races, but really research is better documented in lower salience races where there's not so much noise and attention. And so luckily she was able to get money for both kinds of situations. And so we can compare, like, here in these kind of less intense races, we can really see this working, and it kind of gets lost in the noise in those hot situations.
Did you happen to ever run into a young woman named Janavi Rao, who's a Harvard?
Oh yeah, Janavi. She's part of the Student Vote Research Network, and she's one of our sub-grant recipients.
I was thinking that she might be, because she does. She did that group that was registering high school students to vote, and very impressive young person who's trying to also grow research stuff around that. So yeah, that makes sense. It's a small world.
Listen, we're all... she did stuff with Brian, and then I did stuff with Brian, and then they came to, like, yeah, everyone knows each other.
What should I have asked you that I failed to?
Shoot, it's a really hard question. We've been talking for a while. I told you all my really good stories. Sorry, man.
That's okay. It's funny. I'm approaching my 1,000th episode, and I've asked my guests for that episode to ask me questions, which I don't like being on that side of the microphone, but I'm going to try to answer them. And one of the questions was that I've gotten so far was, you've asked a lot of people this question at the end, and every time I listen, they don't have an answer, although often they do. And so what did come up after that question? So I have to go back and think about... it's very hard to remember any particular episode when you've done that many.
When anybody actually came up with something good.
Yeah. But I think if you wait long enough, then something tends to pop out.
Yeah. I guess the only thing I would say to people is, one of the very small things where I think Don is disappointed in me, and I think he's very proud of me, so I don't want to...
he immediately recommended you.
But I think to a certain degree, he is disappointed that I ended up at Menlo College. I'm not at a Research One school. I'm not even at a school that has political science as a major. I think especially women of color, even though I am not one, but I think a lot of women of color, they do want to go back and be at teaching institutions. And I think it would be great if the folks who are doing the mentoring were more respectful of that preference of, oh, this person wants to be a teacher, and they're making decisions based on what will make their life happy. Part of the reason I am so successful is because I live near my parents and I can ride my bicycle to work, right? I have created this amazing life for myself that is made possible by the fact that I have family support and have a great quality of life. I'm not stressing out commuting. I'm not stressing out that I have to publish 10 articles in the top political science journals this year to keep my job. It's low stress, and I'm very happy. And I think maybe more people of color and more women would stay in political science and be successful, productive scholars and great teachers if we stopped acting like your goal should be tenure at a Research One institution and a huge list of publications. That's not necessarily what everyone needs or wants.
I buy that. Finding the job that's the right fit for you is way more important than finding the job that has the most prestige in the world or whatever. And we ought to value people who find the right place. I think that is in any walk of life.
I have time to run. I have time to hang out with my children. I have time to go on weekend getaways with my husband. I have a great life. And I couldn't do that necessarily, or couldn't have done it as a younger faculty member at an R1.
Well, one other thing that struck me as a little different philosophically between Don Green and you is that he's been so bipartisan or nonpartisan in his work. And you, it's not really partisan exactly, but
I have some clear opinions.
You have some clear opinions and they're not hidden at all.
But that's why I became a political scientist, right? I mean, that's why Dr. Hamilton saw in me someone who wanted to go change the world, because that was kind of the goal. And so it just doesn't even compute for me that you would try to be nonpartisan and not let people know what you think. I'm here to make the world a better place, and I have a clear opinion of what that means.
There is, in some parts of the country, really hard move to change the partisan nature of faculty. Florida, for example. At certain universities, the right wants to follow Viktor Orban or something. And I think in California, in the Bay Area, you're unlikely to be exposed to
safe.
That. You're pretty safe. But I am starting to get, in the world of activism, people who are expressing fears that I hadn't heard about lawsuits by Elon Musk at Disinformation Research World, or at just different aspects of the right-wing machine going after them, whether they're in government, whether they're in academia, whether they're in the activist world. Is that any of that reaching you in your world? Not yet.
Nope. I mean, periodically the president gets, you know, an angry email or something demanding that I be fired, and he throws it away. The president's like, you're doing great. Don't even worry about it.
That's excellent.
I think I'm living a charmed life, man. I told you, everything over here is rainbows and puppies.
It does sound happy. Appreciate talking to you. Anything else you want to say?
I think that's quite enough.
Okay.
Thanks for talking to me. That was really fun.
It was fun. That was Melissa. She is at melissamichelson.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.